Backyard industry is about micro projects. It's about what people are doing at home or in their neighborhood or in their area. So it's not so much about entrepreneurship. It's about it's just about what people can do for themselves. So I would love to hear, for starters, just a little bit, if you could tell our listeners about how you grew up and how what your food tradition is.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Western New York, and by that I mean like far Western New York, in a small rural town called Fredonia, south of Buffalo. And it's definitely an agricultural town. And both my grandmothers, they both canned and preserved things. And I call one my Italian grandmother and one my American grandmother. My Italian grandmother had a big backyard garden and would can tomatoes and made a lot of Sicilian dishes and preserved. She had a big crock, which is one of my most prized possessions now, and she used to make peach brandy in it. And so it was funny because years after her death, she died when I was in high school, and just in the last couple of years, my stepfather found a couple, maybe one bottle of it that hadn't turned, that was in the very depths of the basement. And so it wasn't completely drinkable on its own, but he made it into wine. So it was kind of cool. More than almost 20 years after her death, we tasted a little bit of her handiwork, which was really neat. And then my other grandmother is still alive, and she, in fact, I called her for her birthday the other day, and she was telling me that she was canning. So she canned basically out of necessity. She had a big garden, and she was a housewife, and she had 5 kids. And she was always making a bunch of pickles, and sometimes my grandfather was in construction, and my dad now owns and runs a family business, and he would sometimes be paid in a big hunk of pig. And so they would, especially when my dad was younger, and they would turn that into sausage that they'd be eating for the winter. And so my grandmother was very much about this subsistence living, especially before the business got off the ground. And I was brought up, even though by the time I was young, both my grandparents had, you know, were comfortably middle class or, you know, yeah, pretty much middle class, and they both own their own business. But as you probably can imagine, owning your own business means that you always have it in your mind that something could go wrong. And so both of my grandparents were very frugal in a lot of ways, and they tried to provide as much of their food as possible from their own land. And I really learned that from both of them. And even though it was interesting because my mother and my father, neither of them really were interested in that or kept up those traditions. I, for some reason, and I've kind of delved into it a bit with my writing and, you know, this book, but especially other essays and things, I found that I, once I left the house, I didn't really learn to cook when I was younger. And so when I left and lived on my own in college and afterwards, I wanted to learn these recipes, and then I wanted to learn how to can and make cheese and do all these other things. So I became kind of this DIYer probably around the same time that a lot of other people did in the, you know, early, like 2005, 2006, 2007. I started my own garden a little bit before that, and I became very interested in this. But a lot of it was because I was interested finally in what my grandmothers never were able to teach me. And so I found it very, like I was connecting to my past by learning these new traditions. And then my one grandmother who's still alive, she sent me her recipes, and we've never gotten to can together, but I have been able to use a lot of her recipes, and I've also called her up for advice. So yeah, that's how it's really influenced what I do nowadays, I guess.
So that's interesting because I think I'm probably quite a bit older than you are, but I also grew up not really learning how to cook, not really being that interested in it until you start eating really crappy food, and then you're like, holy crap, I need to learn how to remedy this situation. But one thing, because you talk about your grandmother, and I've read some of your other work too, my grandmother, who was also an excellent cook, she was a farm wife until she was in her mid-20s, probably maybe even a little bit older than that. And when they left the farm, she still cooked, and passed on to my mother the cooking. They're both excellent cooks, but it seemed like for whatever reason, not something that they really enjoyed doing. In fact, my grandmother would, until she passed away several years ago, would send me envelopes stuffed full of coupons for convenience foods. And I'm wondering why your experience with your family and grandparents is different than that, even though they're probably roughly the same age. Why did some people try so hard to get away from it? And like my mother would always ask me, why are you doing things the hard way?
I honestly don't think that it is that different. I know that my grandmother, who's still alive, I call her Grandma, and I called my other grandmother Nani. So Grandma would tell me that she hates to cook and she's not a good cook, even though she's an excellent cook. And even growing up, she definitely had all of these things. Maybe, you know, I'm exaggerating, but in my childhood memory, I'm not, that she had a dozen kinds of pickles that would come out on the holidays or even on a Sunday dinner. But then she also had white bread and salad dressing, no mayonnaise, but not mayonnaise, and lunch meat. And so she had a lot of convenience foods next to these homemade delicacies, next to the pie that she made every week, next to cookies, next to all these things that she made from things from her garden. And so it was an interesting juxtaposition that I think was very typical of the time, where she really made these small batch things to, because she had to, because she, this was how she was saving money, and this is how she was feeding her family. And then everything else she got just from the grocery store, and these were modern conveniences. And then we have my nanny, who, when we were cleaning out her house, when my grandfather went into a nursing home, and I was so excited to find her big box of recipes, and I'm going through these, you know, weeks later, and I'm realizing they were all clipped from the newspaper, not all of them, but many of them were clipped from the newspaper or from, you know, Women's Day or whatever some magazine is. And I was thinking, these were all kind of the cliched 60s, 70s, 80s recipes that were these, also these weird quote-unquote American convenience foods. But I didn't remember her making these. And so I asked my mom about it, and she said, yeah, these were the things that she kind of thought she had to make. And so I see my nanny's story as being very typical of, she is first generation. She was born in the U.S., but then she actually, when she was very young, she moved back to Italy, to Sicily for a couple of years, and then the family moved back to the U.S. So she was born here, but in some ways it was as if she was born in Italy. And I think that's the immigrant's experience, and it's common, where they want to preserve their own traditions, but at the same time they want to provide this level of assimilation for their kids. And so, for example, my mother never learned to speak Italian, and because my grandmother said, why would you need to? And so my mother also never learned can, in part because my nanny said, why would you need to? And so even though she did keep doing some of these traditions, a lot of them, you know, slowly slipped away.
So in addition to your family tradition, what are some other, and then your own experience growing up not knowing how to cook and then getting interested in it, were there any books or people that you met along the way who were particularly influential?
I think I was influenced by the farmer's market, like so many other people. And when I first learned what a CSA was, that blew my mind. Really? I just go every week and I just pick up a whole bunch of fruits and vegetables. It's so cool. And so some things I had to just learn. I had never, in my recollection, I don't think I had kale until, it was a little over 10 years ago now, but, you know, growing up in this farmland, I'd never had kale. And so I was very much influenced by the local farmers and by the people who were doing these things before me. I remember there was this great book, and I just saw that there's a movie out by her, Joanne Gustaw, I think is her name. And she's very well known, but I read this great book about how she was, you know, trying to live off the land in not too far from New York City, but upstate New York. And I just thought her story was very inspiring. And I read Animal Vegetable Miracle, and I thought that was fantastic, where it really got me thinking about local eating. And I was definitely, I called myself a local in the city. I wrote about that for a while. And I am very interested and still am interested in local business and local food. Not militantly so, but just as a means to support the farmers that are close to me and to think about seasonality and to think about freshness and think about small business. I think I got caught up in a lot of the people who were writing at the same time and thinking about the things that I was thinking about.
So let's just moving along toward some of the subject matter in the book. You use the words artisanal and craft, and I'm wondering if you feel like those words have been watered down over the last few years, not just necessarily in talking about enterprise, but just in general talking about food, like as a consumer or as a food innovator. Because I feel like the word local has certainly been watered down.
Yeah, that was kind of it was my first thinking when I wanted to write this book, as it was inspired by the fact that I felt like, oh, artisanal this, artisanal that, and, you know, what does this word mean? And I was so frustrated by the fact that I was hearing, you know, artisanal Frito-Lays or something like that. And so I thought, okay, I want to go to the source. I want to talk to people who are actually making these, who might who I consider artisanal, and I would think that they would consider themselves that, and ask what their parameters are and what they think the word means. So that was my inspiration, and it definitely is being watered down and becoming a marketing word. And, you know, I will say, unfortunately, I'm even suffering from fatigue from that word right now, where I just think, oh, my gosh, I see that word all over the place, and I think it's still does have meaning. And that's what some people said too, where they said, oh, I hesitate to use that word to describe my product, but yet it's a word that still has meaning to consumers, and it's hard to find another word that has the same kind of meaning that encompasses that handmade feel and the feel that it is of higher quality, and it's using these traditions, and it's made with care, and, you know, often made with, you know, environmental sustainability in mind. And so, unfortunately, I don't think we have a better word at the moment, but yes, it's being watered down as we speak.
So as you have the idea for the book, you're putting it together, you are making this list of people you're going to travel to go see. How did you come up with your subjects? How did you find them? What made you decide to choose them over others?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I just had this idea, as we probably often, all most of us do, we're like, okay, you can find anything you want to on the internet. And so I thought, okay, here I want to cover the United States and cover these different industries. So I'll just Google it. And then you realize if you Google, you know, pickle maker in Portland, Oregon, you're going to find a whole list of names and you don't know which are the best ones and who has a good story to tell. And so it was kind of a good reminder that good old-fashioned networking and talking to people who had lived there and people who are in the know, that was the number one way to find these people and find really great stories and people who are passionate about what they're doing. So I was lucky that in New York, of course, I was going back and forth between Boston and New York at the time, so I had a sense of what was going on in both of those cities. Food-wise. And then I met this great woman, Michaela Hayes, who is the owner of Crock and Jar. And she put me in touch with a bunch of people on the West Coast and picklers and fermenters. And so that was great. And so through them, I met a few more people. And that was kind of how it happened with a couple other industries as well, where one person recommended a few other people, and it helped me both have credibility of people who are willing to give me their time, because these artisans are so incredibly busy. So I don't blame them that they don't want to just go talking to anybody who rings their doorbell. But it was really good old-fashioned networking to find all the people, and it was really fun to do. It was fun not to just rely on what I found on the internet, although I did find plenty of people that way as well. But I think some of the best stories were the ones that I found a little more organically.
So how important, you had several examples in the book, you know, where you met the producer, and sometimes the producer would be on site and available to the customer, like at a farmer's market, for example. Other times where the operation had gotten so large that maybe in case of, I believe, was it Seamus the pickle maker, where his operation is to the point now where there may be jars of pickles going out that he never even saw. I think you use that as an example. He never laid eyes on them. So how important do you think the artisan is to the product? I mean, does it really matter that much to people, do you think, buying from a producer? Do you have examples of where, like, people, consumers, were totally taken in by meeting that producer, kind of like meeting a rock star or something?
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, Seamus probably had the biggest reach of any artisan who I met. But I still felt that he was very integrated into the process and into the recipes. And even though definitely there were jars made that he might not have seen, the space is so amazingly small that he probably did see almost all of them, although he certainly didn't touch almost all of them. But you do get that sense that he's still very involved and he's you know, very successful at what he's doing, but I think growing at a rate that seems to make sense. Where there was a distiller on the West Coast, for example, that did seem to be a little bit more removed, where there were more and more people coming in, and I'm not saying that the product suffered at all, but I think that there would be some question about how long they could consider themselves craft or artisanal. Just because I like the definition that Tom Burko from another distillery in Portland, I like that what he had said. He said, you know, the gist of it was that when the person making the product is too far removed from the person making the decisions about money, that's when you start to lose that connection with with craft and with it being handmade and small batch. So I thought that was a really interesting description. But you certainly do see some people have this great following, especially in New York. Everyone, you know, like the Mass Brothers. I spoke with one of, not with either of the brothers, but with Herb, and or with someone who works with them. And so it was really interesting to get the perspective of someone who was at the ground level, but yet I would never have a chance to talk to Rick Mass because right. He is a total rock star and he's doing the rock star thing. So right. There are these different levels, and it also depends on what city you're in too, and I think, and what your scene is.
Sure. So you spent some time in Vermont visiting folks who made cheese there, and then you mentioned Hardwick, Vermont, which is the subject of this book called The Town That Food Saved. Where food really became a huge economic driver for the town. And so you cover a lot of like single entrepreneurs. Can you talk about their place in the food community and the economic community, like food as an economic development tool? Can you talk a little bit about what you saw on your travels as it related
in Vermont or just all over?
I would say in general. I'm using that as an example because that town, the whole town was like very much focused on food as an economic driver.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting. You see these different scenes that they almost consume themselves, and I mean that in a positive way, where more and more people come, and then there's more and more people there, and they just keep growing. You know, of course, Brooklyn is an easy one to talk about, but you have Smorgasburg, where I was talking to, I spoke to the founder after I finished the research for the book and like go into my next book. But, you know, he was saying there was just such an interest for it and that they couldn't even have anticipated, and these are the founders of Smorgasburg and the Brooklyn Flea, that it became this, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy. You build it and they came, and more people came, and they had to keep getting bigger. And there were a lot of businesses in the Brooklyn area where they started at Smorgasburg and moved on to brick and mortar and moved on to, you know, multiple locations. So definitely that's the kind of scene that it kept creating itself and growing and evolving. And then I lived for many, many years in Somerville, Massachusetts, you know, basically part of Boston. And you see that food was such an integral part in that city, changed a lot from when I first moved there over a decade ago. And a lot of it had to do with food, where you had this great farmer's market and just it got bigger and it was attracting more and more people. And now they have this great indoor farmer's market and in this local armory, and they have great restaurants, and a lot of really cool food things are happening there. So I see so many of these businesses being built, and also, you know, neighborhoods being built around food, and not as much some of the other more hard goods. And so I wonder if it's just easier and, you know, you're constantly consuming food as opposed to constantly consuming, you know, handmade bicycles or something. But it is interesting to see that is the harbinger of these neighborhoods changing, I think. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, yes, there's always gentrification. There's goods and bads of that. But I see it, you know, mostly changing for the better and people being more and more thoughtful about the kind of food they eat and where it comes from and how they want to. I think most importantly, how they want to support local businesses. And I think often supporting local businesses, it revolves around food. And I think that's a really positive thing.
When you were traveling, and I suspect I kind of know the answer a little bit because I think the rules are a little bit different on the East and West Coast, where the food scenes are a little bit more developed because of larger populations, maybe a little more adventurous, not quite as homogenous populations as we might have in the Midwest, although that is changing. Did you see any effect that regulation, particularly health department regulation, but really any kind of regulation had on these small batch producers in terms of them being able to get their stuff to consumers at every level, from micro to, you know, your larger pickle producer or your cheese makers, where they have to have the very specific, very clean. You talk a lot about how clean everything is when people are making cheese, and for good reason. I mean, dairy products, you don't want things to be dirty, obviously, or ever to be dirty. But did you see, was regulation an obstacle for a lot of these folks?
You know, there was definitely regulation that they had to work with, but I would say by and large, everyone was very realistic about it and just said, you know, this is something I have to deal with, and the person I deal with is very reasonable, and I know the rules are, and I just do it. I just incorporated it into my system. And I really thought I was going to hear more pushback or more people saying that it was incredibly expensive or that it was too onerous. But I was very surprised in my research to hear people being so realistic about it and just very accepting of it. I would say that, as far as safety regulations and things like that, I know that it, some people kind of half-jokingly said, oh, yeah, we were totally illegal until Whole Foods took us on, and then we had to find a legitimate kitchen. But they were also realistic about that, too. Like, of course, they're not going to be selling the Whole Foods and still be making it out of their kitchen. So that was something that surprised me. Some of the other regulations that did in some ways stand in people's way were certainly the distilling, the story about distilling in the United States, I think, is a very interesting one, where you have some states like Oregon, where not long after Prohibition ended, they just came up with their own system, and there was ways to distill small batch relatively easily and relatively cheaply, and you just had to get a certain license, and they had a state distributor, and so the state had a hand in how all the booze went out all throughout the state. And so that's been in place for a long time, but then you have New York State, where the laws were very different. It was basically incredibly expensive to get a license to distill legally, or else people were distilling illegally all throughout New York State until after 2000. And the fact that, I mean, that just blows my mind. It's like, wow, for that many years, that many decades, it was illegal to distill, except with this $50,000 license. And so that was something that a lot of people have been really working towards, and also to just make it friendlier for small businesses in general. So now it's a much cheaper license, and there's much more friendly regulations, such as the tasting regulation where you can, or law where you can actually give out samples on site, as opposed to having to, you know, sell it to a liquor store or something like that. So that was something that was cited a lot more frequently. And then also there are some things happening with cheese, where just certain styles of cheese can, you know, they're more difficult to produce within these new laws of safety, milk safety, food safety. But for the most part, I think that the cheesemakers have adapted as well, where they're just like, I can't change it, so I'm just going to adapt my recipe and make things the way that they need to be legal-wise. But yeah, I was surprised that it wasn't a bigger deal, because I had heard stories about it really, these laws really shutting people down. And it must have been the people that I spoke to, they had already adapted and just thought, this is the way it is, and so I'm going to just, you know, move on.
So you mentioned price a few times, you know, especially at farmers markets, where a dozen eggs costs X number of dollars, or tomatoes are this much per pound. What are your thoughts on the true cost of food? I'm not sure that that's something Americans necessarily really understand, because so much of our food is so heavily subsidized by the government. So then when they do go to a farmer's market and they see that eggs are twice or three times as much as they might be in the grocery store, they balk at that. I realize that, like, where you live and in the circles that I run around in, many of us don't really think twice about that. That's just kind of how it is, or we live differently, so maybe we spend our money on food as opposed to other things. But I wonder sometimes if small this way, artisanal food or craft food can survive in a country where there's nothing really small about us. We're a huge country with a lot of people, a lot of economic disparity between classes. Is this how do you feel about the true cost of food, and is this something that can is this a movement that can survive for entrepreneurs, not necessarily for home producers, because I think there's always going to be people doing that, but for people who are sort of providing others with stuff that maybe they don't want to make themselves?
You know, I would never purport, like, just, I mean, this is kind of why I was very interested in local food, but then also didn't want to say, hey, everyone should become a locavore, because I don't think there's one right way to solve all of our food ills in America and globally. And certainly there are people who are living in such a manner where they don't have access to fresh food, fresh produce, or they don't have the money for it. And I would never want to say, hey, we should all go small batch all the time. Mm-hmm. I know that I'm speaking from a place of privilege, certainly. But I also think that it's important to have people who do have the means, have them kind of keep these traditions alive and actually support people who are sourcing food in a responsible way. And, part of it is that I just think these products are superior, certainly. I mean, I've become completely ruined for spongy white bread. And once I started getting my my bread from, it's not even a super small batch place, but just a place that doesn't use all those preservatives and that uses ancient grains. And to me, it's just really important. But I have the money to do that. I mean, I'm not rich. I'm I'm a mom and with a stay-at-home dad, and I teach English and I'm a writer. But, you know, I've decided to allocate my money towards that. And we just don't go out to eat as often. And I know that, you know, maybe my grocery bill, the amount I spend on food per month is probably about the same as someone who maybe eats out a lot. But it's also probably more than a lot of other people. So I think that there are people who can make a difference. And I think that I'm so happy that there are more and more people who are interested in asking these questions, because even if you don't have the money to pay for an $8 or $10 jar of pickles, when you start thinking about where it comes from and thinking about who made it and how it was made, I think it just gives people appreciating the process a little bit more. And also, I mean, I get wary. If I see eggs that are too cheap, it makes me nervous now. I just think, why? Food should not be that cheap. And when you think about what it, you know, where it comes from and the space it needs and the feed it needs, and so that, I think we need to start asking those questions. And I hope that people start to think a little bit more critically. And we need the small batch people who are pushing the envelope and putting things out there and saying, hey, you need to think, why is this jar of pickles $10? It's not because the pickler is just raking in $9.50 of it. Right. You know, this, it's $10 for a reason. And so let's start talking about all these costs, the cost that the government's absorbing or the cost that taxpayers are absorbing when you have, you know, $2 a pound beef. Let's start talking about that. So I hope that these small batch people are just starting a conversation. And if it's starting with people who can afford it, that's great. But I think that there's been, you know, evidence in the past of these kind of things. Just it starts a larger conversation that more and more people start to think about. And I actually today, I just was working. I'm a member of the Park Slope Food Co-op in Brooklyn, and I had to work my mandatory shift this afternoon. And, you know, they are the type of place where, yes, it's in Park Slope, which is, you know, relatively expensive to live in, and I do not live in Park Slope. I live a couple neighborhoods away because I can't afford it. But they are very opening, they, you know, they want to – they're so cheap. I belong to it because I can get really great produce and really great products that they have kind of vetted for sustainability for the most part, and I can get it very inexpensive. And so I think that they also are a great resource, and there are a lot of great resources of how to get food less expensive than the grocery store, but of, you know, of better quality and with more thoughtful sourcing. So I think that we're starting to bring this conversation up more and more, and hopefully we can, you know, trickle down to people who don't have the luxury of thinking about it, because it's in more and more places and hopefully more accessible, and hopefully someday that's all of our dream, right? It's not just more accessible, you know, space-wise, but also price-wise.
In your book, you say, and I'm paraphrasing here, consumers gravitate to the narrative of the struggle, which I thought was really interesting. They love hearing the stories about hardship and hard scrabble farm life, and you know, it reminded me so much of a local farmer here. We had several summers of extremely bad weather, and something always was happening on their farm that was a disaster. They had no hay because the grass got washed out from a flood, or they had no chickens because, and so and you know, of course, those of us on the other side of the table at the farmer's market are like, oh my god, you know. And all this obviously was true. They weren't making it up, but it was sort of like almost in a way like, thank gosh it's you and not me. Thank you for growing my food, you know. Why? And do you think that's why so few of us, relatively speaking, gravitate toward quote the struggle in our own lives? And I'm not saying farming necessarily. I'm talking about even cooking for ourselves. I mean, is it something that we find really attractive in others, like, wow, look at them, they're doing that, and I could never do that? Why do you think we're so attracted to that?
Well, you know, this is coming from my other life is as a writing teacher, and I write nonfiction, and I write about food, but also just write, you know, about life and whatever people write about. And I think this idea of drama, conflict, tension, as one of my teachers, Susan Shapiro, said, is apparent in all facets of our life, where we do in some ways – We want to hear about the drama in other people's lives and hopefully have it reflect in ours, where, oh, thank God our life isn't quite as dramatic. But yeah, I mean, as someone who used to have a lot more free time, I loved cooking and I loved spending all my time doing that. And I even, you know, I loved being like, yes, I just spent 6 hours making this very elaborate dish and, you know, hopefully it's going to turn out okay. But now I don't have that kind of time and I miss it. And sometimes I think about other people who do have the time, and, you know, I'm so happy that I know people who can share some of their products, you know, whether it's cooking a meal or canning or making fantastic cheese or something like that, but I just don't have the time to do it anymore. And so they have these people who are doing things better than I used to, but many things similar to what I used to. They become elevated in my mind where I'm like, wow, that is just amazing. They can, you know, yes, I know the technique, but they just have the skill and they have the tenacity and they've spent so much time perfecting their recipe. And but yeah, I do think these people can be kind of rock stars, and I do think they deserve the accolades that they get because they have worked really hard to make this one thing or maybe many things really well. And as someone who has tried to do a lot of these things, I know how hard that is. Mm-hmm. And in some ways I'm kind of glad that I don't have as much time anymore, because why should I spend my time trying to like perfect a pickle recipe when I have all these people who could just, you know, I could just spend some money and buy it when I really want one. So I see a lot of people, yeah, gravitating towards that and really finding, you know, and praising that as they should, I think.
So in your previous life when you had time to cook more elaborately, were you super popular at potlucks? Like, were you always the one that people were like, let's make sure we invite Suzanne because she's going to bring something really awesome? Is that something that you do now with your own family?
A lot of people would say, I don't want to have you over for dinner because I'm afraid you're going to judge the food. Which I hope I don't come across as being judgy, but, you know, I'm afraid to cook for you. You know, what if, and this is the other thing, too, that I find is a problem is that I do, you know, I'm very thoughtful about the things I purchase, but if I were to go to someone's house for dinner and I'm not going to ask them where their meat came from or, you know, is this from a queso or, you know, is this small batch pickle or is it Vlasic? I would never ask someone that. But I feel bad that anyone ever saw that was a barrier between us having dinner together. Now it's just so much easier to have people over for dinner, but we're about to move into a place that's a little bit bigger. And so I can't wait to entertain a little bit more and have people over more often because we'll have a dinner table that can fit more than four people comfortably. Mm-hmm. So that will be really awesome in the future.
My last question is about coming small batch food trends. I'm sure people ask you this a lot or about what's coming down the pipeline. Is there anything that you see? I mean, you cover like really for me, like the basics in life, pickles, cheese, chocolate, and booze. Is there anything else that you can see coming down the pipeline that, is going to be as big of a hit as these things have been, both short term and long term?
These things that I see are probably, I'm very much not the first person to say this, but it was interesting to me being on the East Coast and seeing, you know, especially the New York pickle scene, which is very steeped in tradition, you know, Jewish tradition and even Dutch tradition. And then on the West Coast, fermenting is really huge. So I see, and fermenting for health, fermented pickles, things that are not shelf stable, but things that have to be in the refrigerated section. And so I see that coming to the East Coast and becoming more popular, not just for kind of new agey health reasons, but just for people who are interested in, you know, in local food and no preservatives and things like that. I think that's going to become more prevalent over here. And then I see people doing interesting things with different kind of spirits and cordials and making their own bitters. And I can't wait to making vermouth. I can't wait to see more of those things happening where they're a little bit more accessible, although it's certainly happening in New York and happening in a lot of places. And then the other industry, again, this is not a groundbreaking announcement, but I almost included charcuterie in the book, but then I realized the narrative wasn't quite the same. And also I needed to, you know, get this done in a reasonable amount of time. So I see that as just, you know, more up and coming. And I think more and more people are becoming interested in where their meat is coming from, and a lot of butchers. I have some great friends who just opened a butcher shop in Philadelphia, and I just think that you're going to see more sausage making and charcuterie and things like that. So those are my predictions, but they're not predictions. They are already happening, and I'm just kind of highlighting what other people have already seen. Oh, actually, and I'll say the other thing too is that I just had a great pop-up shop and book event here in New York, and I have a friend, Chitra Agrawal, who owns Brooklyn Deli, who's making this great Indian condiment. It's kind of like a chutney, ketchup-y, delicious thing, and it's unlike anything. It's hard to even say what it is because it's just unlike any American food that we have, and it's so delicious, and my husband and I are absolutely addicted to it. But I bet we're going to start seeing more of these niche products. I mean, we already are seeing these things, but she's been written up all over the place, and it's because her product is so unique. So maybe the next thing is going to be more products like hers, or not anything like hers, but that are super unique, and you know, finding these traditional foods or foods from you know, from cultures that we don't often highlight, and just, you know, doing them even better, perhaps sustainably, and getting them in front of even more people. So I can't wait to find more and more products like that. I'll just say briefly that, you know, I have such respect for all of the small batch makers. I mean, they're just doing really amazing things, and they're putting in so many hours. It's not a 40-hour work week. Usually it's like an 80-hour work week. And, you know, I hope that the book has kind of shown why we should be paying the prices that they're asking for, because, they're, you know, it that is the cost that that these products are, and so, you know, I just want to thank everyone who I interviewed for giving me the time. And then, you know, my next product, I'm starting to look for these kind of stories of how small batch food is looking at making food both sustainably and economically and environmentally, and also preserving traditions, and how this is being played out around the world, specifically in places that don't often get media attention. So I'm excited to be looking at these new stories, and I hope to have more news about the book in the coming months.